Hello there, and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. June Copeman was a business person who for a long time ignored the signs and what her body and brain were telling her to continue to invest in her professional life. Without a balanced work-life existence, her health took a serious hit. Unhappiness, depression, and then cancer, and on top of that, a loss in the family. It was time to reevaluate her life, rediscover her identity, and chart a new course in an environment that would nurture her body and her soul. In this podcast, we talk about relationships, personality profiling, beating cancer, and the loss of her sister. June recently started working as a marriage celebrant in Noosa, and I started by asking her what the most rewarding part of that job is for her.
Seeing the joy in people's faces when they say, "I do." It's unbelievable. The joy that you see in the groom's face when the bride walks down the aisle, it's something that you just don't come across every day. And that little moment, even though it is just a moment, is just like, oh, this is fantastic.
How long have you done it for, Jen?
Look, I'm a fairly new trained celebrant. I started off at the beginning of last year as a celebrant after doing my training. A little bit of a career change for me. A massive career change for me, really. I had a hugely busy life. Talking about work-life balance, I actually coached people in work-life balance but didn't have a work-life balance for myself.
Were you a life coach?
Not a life coach as such, but I had a business coaching and mentoring business. And at that time too, I was also a specialist in practice management, where I helped a lot of healthcare practices and a lot of other businesses to travel the journey they wanted to travel, I guess, which was not to have staff problems and not to have money problems in their business. And part of that was getting their group of people together and getting them to work well as a team and getting the business leaders to actually develop some leadership skills. So,
but tell me more about what you mentioned before, that you were teaching other people to have a great work-life balance and to kind of manage their lives.
Yes.
And yet you said that yours were chaotic, hectic.
Yes, very, very, very so. It got to the stage where I really didn't like doing what I did, but had that little obligation gremlin sitting on my shoulder all the time, wanting to do things for other people and not wanting to do things for myself. So I think if you're a business coach out there, get a coach yourself would be one of those big tips. So I ploughed on and didn't really realise warning signals in my life and in my health, and that started to deteriorate.
Was that the catalyst then for change?
Absolutely. Yeah. Why did I leave it that long? I had a lot of stress going on in my life with just meeting deadlines for people and, you know, just, you know, magnitude of things that you have going on in your life. I think there wasn't any spare time or downtime, and you know, people would say, go and relax, but I wouldn't know how to relax. So hence, yeah, get a coach, I think, would be one big tip that I'd have to say. So
I know a lot of people just like that, June, who
there's a lot of us out there
who need to relax but don't know how to relax. Why is that?
I use a profile tool when I used to work with my groups, and I'm actually starting to use that now with my couples. And it looks at why you do things the way you do them. So it's based on instinct. For me, one of those instincts is driven out of obligation to do things for people, despite knowing.
Like you're a people pleaser? Is that what you
A people pleaser, yeah. Yes, or not being able to say no to them, those kinds of things. So, you know, being able to commit to something without knowing that you've got the resources to fulfill the job, that sort of thing. So that profiling tool has helped me a lot along the way, and I'm finding that really useful now for couples who don't need counselling but would like to know more about how they can communicate with their partner without compromising the needs of themselves, so to, you know, live full and happy lives as such. So,
and this busy, chaotic life that you're talking about, Jim, was that in Sydney?
No, that was in Canberra. Right. So I initially grew up in you've probably picked this up already, but I've got a New Zealand yes. little twang there.
Or part of NZ.
I grew up in a place called Hamilton, which is about an hour and a half south of Auckland. So spent most of my life there, but I couldn't wait to leave. And
why?
Wow, that's interesting, John. Why did I want to leave? I wanted to go to university and I wanted to get out of that place that I'd been in for so long. I guess the grass looked greener. And I also had a boyfriend at the time that I really wanted to be with. So I ended up choosing a uni course that was at the same university as this boyfriend. So I trained as an occupational therapist. It was great. It taught me a lot of skills, a lot of skills dealing with people with physical disability as well as psychological disability. I have had some memorable moments in psychiatric remand centres to doing, rehabilitating cardiac patients to then in my later time as an occupational therapist, I had a group of people that I worked with where we looked after children with learning difficulties, so mainstream kids with learning difficulties. And then I got into the world of business after that and became a specialist in practice management. And part of that was developing those skills of working with people.
We're still talking New Zealand or this is in Australia?
No, in Australia. I came to Australia in 1987.
What was the NZ economy like back in 1987? I imagine that was one of those periods of time where there were a lot of Kiwis coming this way.
It was dreadful. And we came here in 1987. We came here because we had two little kids and we wanted to have like a gap year for ourselves. Yeah. But after a year here, we went back in 1988 to New Zealand, and the businesses that we had left there were just about out the back door. It was everyone was depressed in the streets. There were big organisations, shops closing down, equivalent to David Jones closing down after years.
I only mentioned the economy back in the 80s because to highlight the fact that these days the New Zealand economy is extremely strong. I have a number of Australian friends who have gone over there to work, and I can't attribute where I read this, but it's the first time in 20 years there are more Australians going to NZ than there are Kiwis coming to Australia.
When I go back there as a person who used to live there, I can't see myself living back there now. I don't know where, when you strip back some of those layers, there are still things there that I see as pretty hard and socially challenging with the crime and the violence that is in New Zealand. I know that's a pretty strong thing to say, but it's very, very sad. And, there are some people that do very, very well in New Zealand. I see my own family sort of struggling, and maybe it's because it's a pretty small place. So.
You're talking about Hamilton.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hubby's from NZ as well. What's his name?
Yeah, it's my husband's name's Paul Fleet.
So you had two kids.
Two kids.
Yourself and Paul. And
husband.
And you came to Australia in 1987.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
To Canberra.
What an eye-opener that was.
Tell me why.
Well, everywhere in Australia has got to be warmer than New Zealand, doesn't it, John? Huh? So we came, despite all the counselling our parents gave us about, you can't go, you can't go, you're a family with two small children, you can't go. Anyway, we packed up, we had a one suitcase between the four of us.
That's travelling light.
It is very
light. Just leaving one country to go to start a completely new life.
And we thought, Canberra's got plenty of work on. I could get a job. My husband could get a job. So we arrived in Australia with $300 in our savings bank, two small children.
Jobs lined up. Oh,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, that was good. But realised that in Canberra it gets a little cool. So on the 27th of May 1987 we arrived in the evening, and it was about 5 degrees. And did we pack jumpers for ourselves? No. So maybe a little bit poorly researched out, but anyway, we've not looked backwards. And I actually think when you're in a hard place, the only place to move is forward.
Yeah.
And you have a great respect from, looking back from where you've come to do that. So, we made Canberra our home, and it has been an excellent place.
For how long? How long were you there for?
Well, officially last November, we've moved up here to live. The last 30 years? 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, 30 years in Canberra.
What was the catalyst for the move to sunny old Noosa?
Well, I mentioned before, my health wasn't fantastic. I had, at that stage, I'd sort of suffered a little bit from depression and not wanting to be on the on the planet. Had the medication, had some counselling. It was a good idea to come to Noosa to have a bit of a break, got someone in to run the business while I was gone, just to get away by myself for a few months.
Thinking back, June, was the business the source of that depression? Was that where that came from?
Partly. And partly it's, you know, on reflection now, I don't think, you know, that work-life balance, that there was enough life and purpose for myself existing and throwing everything into my business.
Yeah.
It didn't actually happen as easy as that, because the night before I was ready to hop in the car and drive up here, Paul had made a lovely dinner. We'd had a nice bottle of wine, a bit of Henschke, just loved the vino. And the phone rang at 7 o'clock, and it was my GP. And she said, "Oh, I know, June, you're heading off tomorrow to go and have some rest and relaxation up at Noosa to get things back on track. Can you hang around for the next 10 days? I said, "Yeah, tell me more." She said, "Your mammogram's come back, and there's a couple of things there I'm not happy about. Can you come in tomorrow at 8 o'clock? So we didn't drink one bottle of wine, we drank two that night. And so the journey of the breast cancer began. That would have been in May 2015, so coming up 3 years right. ago. I didn't get to actually come to Noosa for my rest and recovery until the end of that year, after I'd had a double mastectomy, and then also watched my sister die of her breast cancer during that time. So it was a time full of grief and sadness and just your body going through that huge physical punishment that it does when you have surgery. Wow. And all the drugs
What were the coping mechanisms for you? To just reestablish, you were telling me that your job was already highly stressed. You were feeling a little bit depressed. You wanted a change of scenery. And then on top of this, diagnosed with breast cancer and then losing your sister. What was your pillar of strength, so to speak? How did you keep going?
I've often wondered that, because people say to me, "How did you manage all of that? How did you organise your sister's funeral like 8 weeks after your surgery?"
Yeah.
And I look back now and I can't believe what I did. I really, truly can't. I guess there's some inner fortitude there, but, you know, as human beings, when it comes down to it all, what are the choices? What choice do you have other than to pick up your socks, pull up your socks and keep going forward?
Are you a religious person?
No, not at all. But I think I do believe in spiritual things, and things happen for a reason. I was guided by a few friends at the time. I had wonderful support. I didn't even know I had friends. I didn't think I had friends, and everyone came out of the woodwork and helped me out. So that was a big thing. I hadn't realised there were so many people around that actually cared about me.
Yeah.
So that was a very positive thing. But, you know, I look back on it now and go, oh, can I actually thank whoever or whatever or however this happened? Because I wouldn't be in this situation now if I hadn't gone through those things. I wouldn't have the perspective on life that I now have if I hadn't gone through that journey. So feeling grateful, it's made me feel a lot more grateful.
Is that what you've gotten out of that? Because we've all dealt with grief and loss, and I often use the line that you just used, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, look, you often hear, you know, people saying, "Oh, yeah, life's too short to live, but what do you actually do about it?" I think it's becoming a bit of a phrase that we all use, but I don't know whether we action as such. I don't know whether we do our self-audit at the end of the day to say, "So, okay, if life is too short not to live well, what did I do today about it, and what am I going to do about it tomorrow? How is it going to be different?" Rather than being in that same
What was that quote again? Because I like it.
So
life is too short.
Not to live well.
Not to live well.
Yes, yes. We're often too busy trying to make a living, and we forget how to live.
And has your life, now that you've settled in this, has your life changed radically?
Absolutely, yes. I love the beach. I'm at the sea most days, which is fantastic. It just gives me such a sense of freedom to do that. Coming to Noosa has been absolutely amazing, getting out of that big city life and living in a more village-feeling community. Being a volunteer for community groups as well, it gives you a greater sense of belonging in your community. Whereas in the big city, it's just like, well, working, you haven't got time to volunteer for things. So And I guess that was one of the reasons why I wanted to become a celebrant, going, geez, I'm sick of dealing with people's money problems and staff problems. And I'm a very good problem solver. I'm very good at doing that sort of thing, but it's not good for me. And the flip side of being a celebrant is everything opposite to that. You know, these people come, they give you love, they give you joy. Yes, and you're just there as a little catalyst to make it happen. And then you can weave into it all the wonderful, innovative ideas to make their ceremonies unique. Yeah. And that's
so how long have you done it for now?
Well, I've been qualified now for 12 months or just over 12 months, and slowly building up my clientele, and
how many would you do a month, so to speak?
Oh, not so many. Most celebrants when they first graduate do about 5 weddings a year.
Right.
So not many, but I did 10 last year, so I was pretty happy with that, and I've got a wayload booked in the pipeline at the moment.
Yeah.
No, it's good. You get return business too.
I imagine you would, because you would have other guests at that wedding who would say, that's June, and look, I like how she did that. She's got a unique style, or this is the kind of thing I'd like for my wedding. Yeah. I asked you what was one of the most rewarding things. What would be one of the most challenging aspects of the planning, the discussions? You mentioned briefly before about doing an exercise with couples to make sure that they're, compatible? Profile the couple?
Well, as a celebrant, one of the things that you were legally bound to do is to provide access for them to have education, couples education. If you don't do that, you're not doing your job. So, and that's one of the things that I can offer with having my background within, the occupational therapy, and with my background of getting teams of people involved. What does it involve? Filling out a little questionnaire where you think, oh, gosh, these questions are a waste of time, or I could answer them.
Well, it's more psychological, I'm imagining.
Yes. Oh, it is. Yeah. It is. But it's so strategy driven. As an example, I know that my husband and myself are streets apart in how we go about doing things, and communication can be an issue. And I think if I hadn't had that awareness, and for him to have that awareness of how he best communicates, I think we would have split and gone our separate ways a long time ago. I guess
a great example, I suppose, of a couple that's different that get along.
Oh, absolutely. So, we're chalk and cheese.
So
really.
Just because you have a couple in front of you as a marriage celebrant that don't tick necessarily all the boxes.
No.
You still kind of roll the ball forward, I'm guessing. Yes. Is that what happens?
Oh, you do.
Have you ever had to go, look, I think you two, there's no way.
Not my place to say that. I guess I've had couples, well, one of those things, because you're acting as the gatekeeper for Attorney General's Department, you know, you've got to have two people that actually want to get married, and not one coercing the other, or one doing it for the purpose of not being so much in love and wanting a relationship.
Has there ever been one of those cases, for example, June, the reluctant bride, husband-to-be, the reluctant bride-to-be?
I hope I've not ever married anyone that hasn't been truly in love. But you do hear things on the celebrant grapevine. They equip you with the skills to be able to ask the right questions. I wouldn't want to divulge anything.
No, I'm not asking you to name names. I'm just curious as to whether you've seen that happen in front of you and what advice you've given.
You know what? The very first couple that I married, they didn't want to talk about themselves. They didn't want to talk about their love story. They just wanted the sentences to get married. They just wanted to be married. And I thought, oh, why? Why is this? And they were a very close couple. But anyway, we proceeded with all the legal things we had to do. And then I wrote a ceremony for them. And they said, oh, no, that's lovely. Thank you very much. That's just blown us away. And, made us feel a bit teary. And I thought, oh, they're saying the right things. This particular couple, he was from a Greek background and she was from a Kenyan background. Did they want family involved? No, family didn't want them. Family didn't want
them to go ahead. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So we did our ceremony. We had a lovely time.
Family there?
No family.
No.
We had witnesses from the High Commission of Kenya come along to witness the wedding. So again, it's all very...
You felt a bit of pressure, no doubt.
It's a little bit of pressure. Those people have contacted me in the last 3 months and said, we've got to catch up with you. We've got to share some news. And I'm thinking, oh, are they going to tell me the story about what was really behind everything? Anyway, they had a baby.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome. So she was actually pregnant at the time and was very conscious of that. But now the baby's come along, the families are united. So
you just talked about an example there of two people who come from very different backgrounds. Yeah. And then just going back to what you mentioned earlier, June, about the two different ways that you and your husband communicate, because I'm sure there are a lot of couples in exactly the same boat where there are different personalities that make up that couple. Mm-hmm. What did you discover about you and your husband in terms of how did you have to change the way that you communicated to him? And
I've actually wondered whether I should get back into doing some more of that sort of work, but that little gremlin is just sitting on this shoulder, giving me a nudge from time to time. And I go, no, that beach at Noosa is looking much better. Look, it's a company that I use called LinkUp Australia, and they call it the Instinctive Drive Profile Tool. You sit there, you do about 30 questions and you fill it out the way that you would prefer to do things, the way you would want to do them, rather than thinking, well, I'm a husband, I should be doing this, or I'm a boyfriend, I should be doing it that way, and I'm, you know, this is my job, and if I was doing a good job, I should be doing it this way. So you fill it out.
So forget that you're in a relationship. You fill out this questionnaire. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do and how do
we're
you want
to get one for you, John.
Handle this? Well, like I said, I think this is quite a common...
Yeah, it is. So,
So how do you reconcile those two then? Yes. So you've got two very different personalities.
Well, you learn about what you're driven to do and what you instinctively driven to do. I guess maybe if I give you an example of one of the things that that are different for my husband and I, or probably 50 of them, but we'll just do one or two. So. He's probably going to listen to this, isn't he? My goodness.
But very relatable.
Talking
about you and your husband now. We're talking about...
So for me personally, I have an instinctive drive to get things right. Okay, I will look at everything.
Attention to detail.
Yes, if it needs to be, if it's important. So things that are important, I will pick up my ears and go, if it's a problem to solve, I'll love to do that. I'll do the research. I'll nut out the best solution. I'll go and... find four different solutions and then whittle it down to having the best solution. So, yes, I could fill that up with a lot of detail. Being very fair and very just, seeing both sides of the coin, being reconciliatory, that sort of thing. Whereas my husband is driven in extremely the opposite direction. So he avoids that drive to verify, what they call to verify. So he needs the bottom line of things. So if I go, hey, Paul, I've been shopping and I've found this dress and that dress and this dress over there. And by the way, I went and had a look and we could, you know, could go and do a holiday here and a holiday there and give him a lot of detail. Well, I've lost him.
He doesn't want all the detail.
He doesn't want the detail. He wants the bottom line. So in a business... he only wants to see the bottom figure. He doesn't want to see how we've got to it. Having that strategy, both of us knowing that that's what drives us, then we can go, oh, okay, I've got to have a chat to Paul and it'll be just a corridor chat and to say...
But that wouldn't be very satisfying for you though, June.
No, but it depends on what the other person can do to do that. Or I go and sort of suss out people that want to hear that sort of stuff.
Right.
To share my expertise with.
Okay.
That sort of thing.
But you're a person that wants a lot of detail and you're telling me that your partner doesn't, your husband doesn't. So when he has a conversation with you and you want all that detail, what happens? It falls short.
It can do. If you didn't realise it, well, it can frustrate you. But then it's having that knowledge of being able to check in and say, look, I know you want to have that detail, but you know, at the moment I just, oh, that's right, okay, yeah, that's good sort of thing. One of those wonderful things that can come of that, those two different drives, is that when we go shopping, he knows what to pick out first. But I have to go around and check out everything. So I don't do much shopping. I get him to do the shopping because it's so much quicker.
Well, I just thought there was a gender thing. I think that's universal, though. You know, women can go into somewhere and spend. And if I need to get three items from store XYZ, I'm in and out in 5 minutes.
My husband's the biggest shopper. When you meet him, you won't believe it.
The thing about it is, I think a lot of couples are aware of what their partners are like in terms of communication, information they need and information they don't need, but they don't make the effort to actually consistently provide the information and the kind of stories or strategies that kind of dovetails into their relationship.
You know, one of those terms that have been around for a little bit now is emotional intelligence. You know, people are talking about that emotional intelligence. And this is where this system that I've used in the past is all about instinct. So your strategies are intellect driven. So you actually go, oh, hang on a minute, that's what I need to do. So one of the with the system, it comes with, you know, what your natural talents are, what your natural vulnerabilities are as well. So the flip side of a talent is a vulnerability. With that drive I sort of talked about the drive to verify and to get it right, my natural instinct will be, so I only got 97%. Where did I go wrong? How could I get that extra 3% without going, oh, hang on a minute, you've got 97% right. And the same goes for, you know, if you're in that working situation and you've got to develop something, someone comes to you with a project that they've done and you can see that they've only got 70%, you always ask them for a draft rather than the end process because you know you're going to pick holes in it.
Yeah.
So, and they know that they can come to you with a draft as well.
In a workforce scenario, though, isn't the beauty the diversity that you have between all those different personalities? So can I ask, going back to a couple in a relationship and a couple, if you had two people that were very heavy on the detail, big picture, you would think, okay, that's a marriage made in heaven. But can that have its shortcomings as well when you've got two people who are very identical, overload on the information or vice versa, are very kind of, you know, don't talk a lot?
Those are the people that you don't invite to your dinner party.
No, but what I'm asking you, I guess, if you have two people with exactly the same traits, it's not always...
Well, they're not going to see the whole world.
That's right.
They're not going to see the whole world.
And it comes back to that diversity of views, doesn't
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. So opposites attract,
the old saying. Yes, that's right.
Opposites do attract. But it's like living with that opposite and having the strategies to go about doing
understanding how to cope.
How to cope. Absolutely. Yeah, right. Maybe I'll get back into doing some of this.
No, I hope that this podcast hasn't been a catalyst for you then to start thinking.
Oh, you know, it never leaves me. It never leaves me. But maybe I can help some couples out there just get to know and understand each other a little bit more and maybe use some strategies to go, oh, hang on, okay, so we are at sixes and sevens here. Ah, oh, that's because I like to do it this way and you like to do it that way. Okay, well, let's find the middle ground.
Yeah. Sort of thing. Do you ever envisage leaving Noosa?
I need to go to Hawaii. So, I love that place.
So I do love Hawaii. I've been there a couple of times. So this is home, like a long term.
Yeah. We're bedding in now. We've bought a house, and you know, I've got involved with trying to market my business, trying to get my name out there. It's not an easy place, Noosa, to be a celebrant. I think
In what way? I would think a lot of people.
There are so many here.
Oh, too many celebrants.
A lot
in the market.
Of celebrants. I guess for me, finding my niche with that, or looking at what I want to be doing with that, because there's a lot of different ways, shapes, and forms to actually get married, and I sort of like to think that I might be able to offer people things a little bit different, or to do things a little bit more different, that's tailored to their needs. So I know that the one of the last weddings I've done, the bride and groom, very sporty couple, and I said, well, who's going to go first with reading your vows? And they said, oh, doesn't the groom always have to go first? And I said, no, there's no rules. Being a celebrant's great. There's very few rules and just loads of options. So let's see how many different things we can do. Yeah, right. So we ended up tossing a coin during the ceremony.
That's
great. And it was fun.
Was that your idea?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's good. And I've had another a wedding where they've gone, oh my goodness, who do we choose as witnesses? And I said, well, don't let it be a burden. We can actually choose on the day. We can put all the names of the guests in a hat and draw two out. And they said, can you do that? I said, long as they're over the age of 18, that's not a problem. So, and again, trying to put in that fun element and
a nice little twist.
And a little twist to go, oh, gee, that was fun doing that.
Gina, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing your stories.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been great to talk to you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, John.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed listening to that podcast. I hope it inspired and informed. And if it did, if you were touched by that or you got something out of it, it was relatable to you, it connected with you, well, then I'd love for you to share it with family and friends on social media. And if you are listening via iTunes, Stitcher or Wooshka, please rate and review the podcast. Remember, there are two fresh Conversations in Noosa podcasts up on our website each week, every Monday and Thursday. Head to innoosamagazine.com.au/conversations.